This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
Faces. And I want to thank Joseph and all of you for welcoming me here. Since we're such a small group, I'm going to be talking about judgments. And so I thought maybe we could just go around the room to start and each say something that we have a judgment about. So, like, for instance, I have judgments about people who drive minivans. So maybe we could start with David and just go around the room.
Do we have enough time?
Yeah, we do. Oh, well, yeah, I know. Just one thing, okay? Just one thing that you're judgmental about.
People who talk on cell phones when they drive.
Ah, yes. You have to pick one.
I know.
It's hard, I know. Okay.
About everything that I don't worry too much about because I have no means of enforcing that.
Yeah. Right.
You know, as a board member, I always think about our board. I'm constantly judging us as to whether we're doing a good job or not. And it's sometimes scary, you know, because you know, I notice boards get old after a while, and they get small in number sometimes, and I wonder, oh boy, so much depends upon a few people showing up, you know, and that always makes me, I judge that a lot. You know? Anyway.
I don't know, I have a hard time seeing a specific thing, but it's interesting that you bring this up because just this morning at breakfast, I was talking with David, and that a judgment came up. We're being judgmental. I've been talking about, you know, Chogram Trungpa, who many people say is a great teacher, but, you know, I've always had mixed feelings about certain things that he's done. And so we were talking about other people too, but then I also thought that, you know, the problem with some of these issues that going too far on the other spectrum also can be bad, like you know, getting too puritanical, that there's inevitably hypocrisy and, you know, people kind of doing really terrible things because they've repressed everything. And mm-hmm. So it's like, and then it makes me think of the whole, you know, he who's without sin, throw the first stone or whatever, you know, it's like we're all capable of. None of us are perfect and all. But it does make me wonder still, it's like, yeah, being judgmental is bad, but at the same time, people are really behaving badly and hurting other people and hurting themselves. It's like, should we just totally let them get away with it? You know, it's like, mm-hmm. but like, how do we do that without being judgmental? And I don't know, those are like big questions in my mind.
Yeah, good thoughts.
If you know the answer, please let me
know. Oh, yeah, okay. That's why I'm here today, because I know all the answers. Not.
Well, I guess I'd say my family, my siblings spending way too much money on themselves.
Mm-hmm. Did you pick one?
Yeah, people who are not doing their fair share.
Oh, interesting.
As I do.
Right.
That's driving me crazy the last few years is people with relentless optimism. It's just like bullshitting all the time. How can you live like that? I judge them harshly.
Yeah.
No, it's not okay. And you haven't addressed my issue at all. This will address your issue, no, it won't.
Excellent. So yeah, it's a rich line of inquiry. And so in the Metta Sutta, we chant, even as a mother watches over and protects her only child, so with a boundless mind should we cherish all living things, suffusing love over the entire world, above, below, and all around without limit, cultivating an infinite goodwill toward the whole world. And in this teaching, the ideal love of a mother is for her child is held up as an example of infinite compassion. An ideal mother's love responds when her child is hungry and even anticipates and feeds the child before the child asks for food. An ideal mother, when the child is in danger, will risk her own life. An ideal mother cherishes her child with a boundless love. So the Buddha taught us to love all beings as a mother loves her only child, or we could even say as an ideal parent loves a cherished child. If we can do this even to a small extent, I think the world would be a gentler and kinder and safer place. It's this archetype of the capital M mother that is invoked in our Mahayana practice of cultivating a loving and compassionate mind in order to benefit all beings. But how many of us had that kind of mothering or parenting? I didn't. I wasn't raised with a role model for infinite compassion, the sort of boundless love that cherishes all beings, an infinite goodwill toward the whole world. Quite the contrary. So how does one cultivate that when one is confronted with beings, especially other humans or situations that are hard to love, like people who are ridiculously optimistic? Several weeks ago, I had an experience that made me think about this question. I was going to my car in the Civic Center garage, if some of you know it, and the elevator was crowded, and the last person to get in the elevator was a man with very matted dreadlocks and kind of wild eyes and terrible body odor. But none of that's really particularly unusual in the Civic Center garage, so I didn't really think anything of it. And he wedged in next to me in the elevator. And I always take my keys out of my purse before I go to my car. So I had taken my keys out and I was holding them. And the elevator went down to the first floor and several people got off, including this man. And as he got off the elevator, he turned around and looked right at me and said, "Give me the keys." And I backed away, shaking my head. I said, "No, these aren't your keys." And he says, "Those are my keys. You know they're my keys. Give me my keys." And he was very aggressive and very directed towards me and very persistent. And I'm backing away and backing away. And as the elevator's doors are closing, he says to me, come on out here, I need to talk to you for a minute. And luckily the elevator door is closed. I'm like, no, I'm not gonna come talk to you. And it was so strangely personal that one of the women in the elevator who was standing next to me said, looked at me and said, do you know him? I said, no, I've never seen him before, and these are definitely not his car keys. And I realized, obviously, that it wasn't personal, and yet I felt really violated and frightened by it and sort of attacked. And as I was leaving the garage, I even told the garage attendant about it, because I thought that this man might be wandering around in the garage and might be a danger to other people. So I felt somehow that I had encountered some manifestation of evil and was really shaken up by it. More recently, this problem of how to cherish all beings manifested for me in a different way with a couple of my clients. For purposes of confidentiality, we'll call them Jesse and Walt. We don't have any Breaking Bad fans here. So, what?
Crickets,
yeah. So, Jesse and Walt, both of them are single fathers who had been given custody of their children, sole custody of their respective children in previous court cases. And they had both dropped out of school in the 11th grade, coincidentally. And then they both had subsequently had their children removed from them again because of problems in the home. And they're not adequately caring for their children. And so I, in each of their cases, was advocating to keep their case open so that they could continue to try and reunify with their children. And there were problems with both cases where the social services agency was asking to terminate their reunification and move to have the children adopted. And so in both cases, for various reasons, I lost, we lost. And so I had to file appeals for each of them. And that's where the problem arose for me. So in Jesse's case, Jesse is a meth addict with a 20 or 30 year history of drug use. And he's functionally illiterate. He has about a second grade education. He has cognitive delays and emotional regulation issues that may or may not be related to his meth use. And in many ways, he's like a little kid himself. He was homeless and living in a car when I first met him. And now he's in a residential drug treatment program and working hard to turn his life around and doing remarkably well. And after working with him for more than a year, I've actually grown quite fond of him and really wanted to help him. And so I put a lot of time and effort into his appeal. I really cared about it. I was really, you know, struggled with it. And then about a week later, I had to write Walt's appeal. And Walt also had a difficult childhood and started dealing drugs as a teenager and was also probably a pimp and had spent many years in and out of prison, most recently for charges relating to breaking into a woman's apartment and beating her up. And he was angry and demanding and had done virtually nothing since his child was removed to try and get her back again. And I noticed that I had many more negative judgments about him and his case and his situation. And consequently, when it came time for me to write his appeal, I came up against these judgments, and it made it really hard for me to really care about his case and to really want to work on his appeal. I kind of had to force myself to do it, which is a dramatic contrast to how I had been feeling about Jesse's appeal. So I was thinking about the differences between these two fathers and noticing what judgments and stories I had in my mind about them. And, you know, found myself asking how I could cherish each of these very differently damaged, flawed men with an equally boundless, compassionate mind. I wanted to read something from a book that I love called Bearing Witness. It's by Bernie Glassman. It's one of the first Dharma books I read, actually, and it really moved me. And he says, if we could live in the world as if everything and everyone is Buddha or Christ or the divine, we would take care of each situation that arises in a natural and spontaneous way. But almost all of us exclude someone or something. It might be a person of a darker or lighter skin color, someone with a strong body odor because he or she lives on the streets and hasn't washed in several weeks, or someone coming at you with a knife, or, you know, in my case, someone coming after your car keys. And then he goes on to say, it happens moment after moment. Most of the time, we're not even aware of it. When we see someone who doesn't look like us, who has different customs from ours, or who speaks a strange language, a slow process of dehumanization begins. We may not consciously think badly of him or wish him harm, but we don't believe that he's quite as human as we are. This is often a subtle process, and noticing it requires attention, honesty, and sensitivity. And sometimes it's not subtle at all. So this dehumanization, I am engaging in this when I think of the man in the elevator, or the father who's a drug dealer and a jerk, as someone separate and other. When I get caught in the belief that the causes and conditions that have brought me to this moment in my life are somehow superior to the causes and conditions that brought the man in the garage to confront me. Someone he had never seen before that day. Or superior to the causes and conditions that led my client to become a drug dealer and a pimp. Or led my client to become a meth addict as somehow an answer to the suffering that they were experiencing. So I ask whether I can see myself in the mentally ill, unwashed man who accosted me in the elevator, or whether I can see the causes and conditions that might give rise to the state of being in my own life. Or can I see myself as a man who lives in a car and uses meth? Or as a man who sells drugs and prostitutes out of a hotel room with his toddler present? These are the sorts of questions that arise for me every day in my work with the clients that I see. And in order to manifest the truth of the teachings, to cherish all living things with a boundless mind, I have to find a path to a kind of radical acceptance. I believe that, as with everything in our practice, it starts with this one. In order to find compassion for demons, we must know our own demons intimately. Our demons are our spiritual advisors. They lead us to the path and nourish our practice. Our psychic equilibrium cannot be gained by suppressing or pushing away these undesirable aspects of ourselves. I must know that I am someone with sometimes harsh judgments, I have judgments about people who drive minivans. When I get stuck behind them on the road, I find myself silently cursing them because I can't see around them and they're always driving slower than everyone else. I have judgments apparently about drug dealers. Left to its own devices, my mind can be a hell realm of criticism and self-criticism when I create these kinds of separations between myself and others, when I forget that they are not out there and that I'm nothing special. Who knows, someday maybe I would be driving a minivan, but probably not. But I block the unfolding of my essential nature when I judge myself and others, when I forget the causes and conditions that gave rise to their being in the world at this moment are just as unfathomable as the causes and conditions that have led to my sitting here and talking with you today. I find that curiosity is one antidote to this. So when I turn towards my judging mind with the spirit of, what is this? Or who's judging whom? I'm able to see a wider array of possibilities, to touch my own suffering, and to start to feel tender towards myself and towards the world. Curiosity can quiet our stories. It can open the way to bodhicitta, to way-seeking mind. It searches out everything that could possibly be of value in our lives and makes all of it, even drug dealers and meth addicts, even minivans, a rare and precious Dharma gate. My beloved late teacher, Darlene Cohen, used to say that you can only appreciate others' heroism if you can know what it takes to function and go through life with a body and mind. Likewise, I think that we can begin to fathom others' suffering when we deeply know what it takes for us to get through our own life with this body mind. If we continuously turn toward our own essential flawed humanness, we can see others in ourselves, we can see ourselves in others. We can, if not understand, at least realize the mystery of the causes and conditions that give rise to circumstances and we can be curious enough eventually to be patient and kind with ourselves and with others whose causes and conditions and suffering may not look exactly like ours. And eventually, if we're curious enough, we will stop being patient with our own suffering and perhaps this will lead us to choose a different path away from judgments and toward cherishing the whole world with an infinite goodwill. So I think I've rambled on for a bit, and I would love to hear from other folks' thoughts and questions. Yeah.
When you're training as a lawyer, how does this issue get addressed? I mean, is it sort of looked over and you just kind of deal with it as you're working on the job training, or does it get addressed in some way?
In sort of general training as a lawyer, no, it really doesn't get addressed at all. At least it wasn't when I went to law school, which was, you know, eons ago. I think they're maybe a little bit better now at talking about client relationships. But the area of law that I work in is really specialized. And so most lawyers don't deal with the kind of extreme circumstances that I often find myself in. Although criminal lawyers all similarly, you know, have a similar clientele. But you know, you have to be a zealous advocate for your client regardless of their circumstances. So you have to find a way. But yeah, that's a good question.
I think that's what, I mean, it sounds to me like an impossible situation, right? Because especially for a Buddhist priest, right? I mean, the whole setup of the legal system is that you are advocating for one against another, right? I mean, it's set up as this, you know, dualistic opposition. And whether you know, believe it or not, whether it's turned your stomach or not, you still have to do your best to come through. I mean, you would have it on your conscience if that guy got his kid back.
Right.
You would worry about the kid, right?
Right. Yeah.
Right. And you would think, okay, more reasonable situation, we sort of bring everybody together and come to agreement, this benefits everybody, because it's not like the father is Buddha and the baby isn't Buddha, right? I mean, you sort of have to bring it. But you don't get to work in that situation. So it just sounds really, really difficult. I mean, do you have to take a case? Can you say, you know what? I'm not going to advocate for you because you should not have that baby. It wouldn't be the best thing for the world. Find another lawyer.
In the cases where I'm appointed by the court, I generally don't have much of a choice about who my clients are. So I've represented sexual predators, people who've been convicted of murder, and, you know, lots and lots of parents who have severe mental health and emotional issues and drug substance issues and so forth. And it's a practice for me. It's, you know, Mio very kindly once acknowledged that it's part of my ministry. And I don't know how people who don't have a spiritual practice do it, because it's certainly something that I practice with every day. Seeing my clients as human.
Yeah, I saw my, you know, I mean, I had patients who were, you know, similar. Of course, I didn't have to do the advocacy legally, you know, but this case managers and social workers would do that. And I would say it would be much better for this woman to be in prison for a few years.
Yeah.
It would, like, be a stable environment. She wouldn't be hurting. You know, it's like, oh, we can't go there. It's like, why not go there? You know?
Yeah.
It seems like people have these professional parameters. So I'm just wondering. I mean, it's a ministry, but what is the fulfilling, or what do you take from or give to that you feel is actually helping?
Helping.
Or why is it a good use of the light? I'm sorry, I haven't had breakfast. So.
No, that's okay. A good use of the light.
Yeah, right. You're one wild and beautiful life, right? I mean, why this?
Mm-hmm. Well, I ask myself that sometimes. Partly, it's a labor of love. I don't think it's hubris to say that I want my clients to have an experience of someone who believes in them. And I have had cases where there's been success and where my clients have expressed tremendous gratitude because I was the one person who didn't stop believing in them. And it made a big difference in their lives. You know, it's work that's interesting. I'm passionate about it. And in the same way that I think that, I guess it's okay to say that I think people deserve to be seen as human. And my clients deserve to have someone who's in their corner. And so I'm that person.
Using the Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
Motif.
Great shows on television.
We could take Saul as the type of attorney that you don't want to be.
Right.
Because he's actually aiding and abetting
right.
criminals.
Right.
So you're not doing that.
No.
You're taking what has to be seen, I think, as the middle way here. Oftentimes you're dealing with people who are involved with criminal behavior, and yet at the same time you have to somehow, you know, craft a case in such a way that you zealously represent the interests of your client
mm-hmm.
without becoming, a crutch to this person
right.
to go on doing,
right.
you know, things that aren't good for them. So I think you're doing that, you know, which is about as much as anyone can expect, you know. Well, I don't think you could do much more.
Thanks.
But do you get to motivate, you know, saying, you know what, if you're up in court high, you know, that won't be so good for you, so maybe you should get into a program, and that way the judge would view your case more famous. Is that part of the job?
I do have those kinds of conversations
mm-hmm.
with my clients, yeah.
Motivation, because...
Yeah. Sometimes you have to have the, what I call, come to Jesus talk.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. People outside, this was a particular sort of frustration because, you know, my 3 years in the, you know, case management program with the case manager saying, we can't be judgmental. We engage in motivational interviewing so the client will see for themselves. I'm like, yeah, but towards what? You've got a judgment. You know what's better for
mm-hmm.
them and what's not better for them. Why don't you just admit it?
Yeah.
And then you can work it rather than tying yourself in circles logically saying, well, I can't be judgmental, but I want him to do this thing. It's like, there's nothing wrong with that. That's you know. Oh, sorry. Yeah. I'm going to have lunch. But this idea that it's somehow wrong to have, you know, a judgment when you see that, you know, it would probably be better if that baby didn't step in, you know, that five-year-old didn't step in front of that car, you better do something, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have that situation with other human beings as well. You know, that is not actually going to be, you are going to regret that tomorrow, I can guarantee it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's okay to intervene.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a judgment? I don't know. Does it
well,
matter?
I think there's a distinction between being judgmental and being discerning, at least the way I'm using the language, that it's important to discern what's beneficial and not beneficial and what's wholesome and not wholesome and what will lead to, you know, a healthier outcome and what will not. I think the distinction that I'm making is that with judgments come stories, and they come out of our ideas about what is. And they, I think there's some ego involved in the kinds of judgments that I'm talking about. Like I was saying in the talk, you know, that my causes and conditions are superior to that person's causes and conditions. Or, you know, my circumstances in life are somehow of higher value than the other person's circumstances. I think that's different than, you know, trying to ascertain what would be beneficial in a situation.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, that's how I would think about that.
I think that the question of, you know, what would you do? I was on Market Street last week waiting, you know, standing outside the gym waiting for Chuck to come pick me up, and a guy came up Market Street with these, you know, jerky gestures and just taking up the whole sidewalk with these kind of spastic movements, and
you know, and you know, bare feet, dirty feet, the whole thing, and it stops in front of the building, and just, and he was carrying the white pillow and a plastic glass and a bottle of water. And he stopped in front, just a few feet from me, and he was, you know, doing this stuff against the wall, and would get down and kneel on the pillow and do it on the ground, and, you know, not interacting with anybody, not talking to anybody, just, you know, doing these movements, and then he'd stop and pour water and drink it and keep on doing the, you know, and people were walking by, you know, looking at him, and another guy is, you know, kind of, you know, crusty gentleman who's constantly yelling military sort of, you know, epithets at people. That's why he goes, yeah, since the day he got his head blown off, it was the same sort of thing. And then, you know, the home folio, the gym goers with the young one guy walks by, you know, past him, looks at me knowingly and says, yoga. And I thought, yeah, yoga. Yeah. And was, you know, and I thought, you know, I'll write a, you know, an essay for the newspaper that says, okay, in the same situation, what would you do? Because this guy is really making it. I mean, this guy is doing so well compared to, you know, to the you know, the new, you know, because look at it this way. I mean, what he's got was dystonia, right? I mean, it was, you know, and it was dystonia on top of what was probably, you know, tardive dyskinesia and all these side effects, because he took the antipsychotic drugs that people were giving him all those years, because they didn't have anything better to give him, right? And so these permanent movement side effects, and he's able to hold that together and go down the street and make it look like he's dancing, and not hit anybody, and not call out to people and yell at them in a way that would get him locked up somewhere that's much worse. He's out there enjoying the sunshine on a Sunday afternoon, and he's managing, he keeps pulling his shirt up, he's managing to keep his pants on, you know, and he's managing to keep hydrated while he's doing all
that's
this,
remarkable,
you know?
Yeah.
It's like, he is doing so much better than you or I would do in that situation, right? And they're going to walk past it. Oh, he's succeeding more, you know, the latest entrepreneur who's come out and opened a new .com and wants to clean him off the street while he's busily, you know, not making payroll and then, you know, going bankrupt and owing money on the rent. That's somebody who's making it, you know, it just drives me crazy. Mm-hmm. So I think if there's a way to you know, help people think, okay, in that situation, how well would I do, you know, as opposed to what a disgusting situation that might somehow be helpful.
Yeah.
So there's always a compassionate way that you agree with, you know, don't you think? I mean, there was a story about, who was this, Angulimala? Buddha took him on as kind of a case that was probably not going to work out, but he gave it an honest shot anyhow. I guess the guy was kind of a serial killer and used to wear body parts around his neck or something.
Yeah.
Anyhow, he had an unsavory past. And, I guess he came to the Buddha one time and said, people are throwing rocks at me, you know. Buddha said, well, you know, it's just your karma coming back to you. And, you know, yeah, people are going to throw rocks at you. They hate you because you've done a lot of bad things. So I think if you can at least get people to the understanding that their past life impacts them and will continue to impact them, and but you'll do the best to help, you know, in whatever way, that's about it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there is always a compassionate way. It's not always clear what that is. And maybe isn't even always one way. There's, you know, many, many ways. But if we have the intention to not dehumanize others and to acknowledge that no one wants to suffer. Even other obnoxious lawyers I've encountered. I had a situation where I was in an argument. Well, it wasn't really an argument, it was just another attorney who was being really insulting towards me. I was trying to have a conversation with him about a case, and he was just being insulting. And I just looked at him and I said, you know, that's just not necessary. And I realized that you know, he doesn't want to suffer. This is just his response to his own suffering. And he actually backed down and apologized. And so, yeah, no one else wants to suffer.
Nobody wants to suffer.
Nobody
but
wants
just because
to suffer.
Somebody's suffering doesn't mean something is wrong, as Theo once said to me.
Oh, well, there's...
Bruce and I were talking a little bit before the talk about, you know, sort of the experience of being, you know, kind of, you know, sissy boys, you know, and then being very much attracted to, you know, powerful physicality later on. And, you know, I thought, you know, I've just always abhorred violence, you know. I thought, well, why am I, do I abhor violence because I abhor violence? Because abhor violence because I assume I'd always be the victim, I would never win in a conflict,
yeah.
You know.
You
know, so there's that. So when I get too much, oh, these horrible people, you know, they're violent. It's like, well, yeah, they're violent. So maybe that's why, you know, there's that very annoying line in the New Testament, right? The kingdom of heaven suffers violence, and the violent will bear it away. You know, and that probably is not, you know, in there to encourage people to be violent. It's probably for people like me who want to judge people for being violent because, you know, I'm afraid of, I would always be a loser. No, I don't. But I'm really going to stop any month. So.
Yeah, I think it's almost tea time. So I don't know. Maybe one other comment. Or not. Thank you.
Tension equally extends to every being and place, with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them.